This is the State of Things from the Friday Center in Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Thank you. The fight for gender equality in the U.S. is often marked publicly by visible marches and landmark court decisions. I mean, think about the hundreds of thousands of people who packed the streets this January in pink cat-eared pussy hats, or the seminal 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. But the movement has really been fueled day to day by the work of activists, organizers, and regular citizens. And the specific agenda is ever evolving, from the right to fair wages and equal pay to a push for a movement that is truly intersectional, one that embraces how overlapping identities like race, class, or sexual orientation affect the way people experience the world. So, where exactly is the movement for gender equality today? Who are the key players, and what are the issues that they are focused on? Well, those are some of the topics that we're going to tackle this hour. We're recording this special show in front of a live audience as part of a year-long celebration of the 20th anniversary of the Carolina Women's Center at UNC Chapel Hill. So congratulations to the center. Thank you for being here. And joining me first is Lisa Levenstein. She's a professor of history at UNC Greensboro who specializes in women's movements throughout history. Lisa, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
So you've been looking at the big trends in that have shaped this movement for a few decades. Let's talk about this. Beyond the marches and the sort of the big events that we see, what characterizes this movement over time?
So I think to understand this question, Frank, which is, you know, really, you put your finger on it. I think we have to go back to the 1990s. And this was a moment, I've done a lot of research on this decade. And this is a moment when really people were saying two things about the movement. One was there were the people who had said, feminism is over, it's dead, you know, that we're in a post-feminist generation. That was one refrain that you might hear sometimes in the media. But another refrain, which I think is the more interesting refrain and is something that has really borne out in my own research. I've been doing research on this for several years now, both archival research and also speaking with the activists of that decade. People would say, feminism, what is it? It's everywhere, right? They couldn't put their finger on it, yet it seemed like somehow it was everywhere. And it really... what that captured was a real distinction between the feminism of the 60s and the 70s, which, you know, we think of as, you know, the kind of sit-ins, the marches, the consciousness-raising groups. Suddenly in the 90s, it seemed to be everywhere, but no one could really put their finger on where the everywhere was. So one of the things I've been doing in my research is trying to find what everywhere is. And two things I think might be important for us to start thinking about. First is kind of institutionalization. And I think it's really interesting that we're here today to celebrate the anniversary of the Women's Center. So, because one of the things that happened to feminism is it became institutionalized. And by that I mean it became embedded in institutions such as universities being one. There were both women's studies departments, women's centers, student organizations on campus doing feminist work. But you also saw it in other institutions, in the healthcare sector, women's health specialties, for example, in the legal sector. So feminism is becoming institutionalized, and so this is a new look for feminism, and it's harder to put your finger on where it is.
Precisely because it's promoting, and I think you started to describe it, maybe I'll ask you to amplify, the intersectionality, the fact that it is more than just equal pay and some of the other things that the initial movement, at least the movement of the 1960s and 70s, were promoting, that it does begin to touch many other areas of life and
absolutely
other
cultures. And I think the other way, along with institutionalization, the other thing that happens is kind of a process of professionalization. And when I say that, I don't mean doctors and lawyers. What I mean is, for example, we had really a moment where nonprofits become one of the key ways that feminism is done. So various kinds of organizations, whether that's a rape crisis center, a domestic violence organization, an organization promoting economic justice in which women of color happen to be the people on the front line promoting a very feminist agenda in that institution. Feminism is becoming, so this kind of professional, when I say professionalized, what I mean mean is that increasingly it's something that people can do for pay. It's something that they're getting grants to do feminist work, or they're making some kind of a salary, whether that's coming from a university, whether that's coming from a nonprofit. They're somehow making a living off of doing feminist work. And that's another really distinct shift that we see. I mean, this had always been a trend in feminism, but it really begins to take off in the 90s, and then we still see this today.
Does it change the nature or the quality of work once it becomes a profession or institutionalized? Seems like that's a double-edged phrase, professionalization, institutionalization.
Absolutely. And so at the same time that feminism is becoming more entrenched in institutions and in nonprofits, some feminists also, and this is actually happens mostly at the grassroots, where you know you have people who are really making sacrifices to make a living off of feminist work, because if anyone in the audience or people on this panel who have done this know, it doesn't pay a lot, right? You're not doing this for financial gain. But what they're realizing is that along with professionalization, along with institutionalization, if you're doing this for a paycheck, you're answering to somebody, that person who is giving you that money, whether that be a grant, whether that be a salary, you are now having to answer to that person. And it really creates a lot of tension for people who are both see it as a tremendous gift to be able to do this for their life's work and to be able to make a living doing it, and at the same time see the limitations that that sometimes poses on them. And so you have, for example, a group called Incite, Women of Color Who Are Against Violence. They come up with they coined the term, but really people have been talking about it for several years, even decades, the nonprofit industrial complex, to kind of summarize the real tensions that come out of doing work in a kind of more professionalized way. And again, this isn't just, when I say professional, it's not just the elite, it's all the way down to the very grassroots that we see this happening.
And in terms of even getting attention, you've done research that shows that women of color have been a part of this movement for a long time, but not recognized as such, but really were in the vanguard of the movement back in the 50s and 60s.
Absolutely. Women, we know that, you know, historians have really done, I think, really a fantastic job tracing the lineage of women of color feminism, also working class women's feminism, lesbian feminism, and showing that these strands are not something that just kind of have appeared in recent years, but they've been really key parts of the movement from its inception. What I do think starts to shift in the 90s, and now even today, you can really see the fruits of some of this, is that these voices, which may have once been kind of considered more to be on the margins of feminism, weren't being picked up by the media, weren't being necessarily addressed in the high-profile events that got attention as being feminist events. Those voices are now much more central to the way all feminists do their work. Now, they might, you know, there's a lot of tension over the degree to which people incorporate these other perspectives. But I think, for example, if you think about the Women's March in 2017 and you read that platform, the platform that they put forward, that is a platform that is kind of intersectional at its core, that really is addressing the issues that women of all kinds, and also trans women as well, that people of all kinds face, and that was also a movement that was led by a multiracial group of activists. And I think that really signals this kind of shift in the center of feminism that we see really start to take shape in the 90s and continue till today. Again, it's an unfinished shift, right? But I think you really start to see this.
How much did digital media and digital communications have to do with that shift?
Oh, I think the rise of, 1995 is kind of the year that historians mark as being kind of the cusp of the digital revolution. And it would be interesting for us all to think about what we were doing in 1995, what was your relationship with email or the web or these kinds of things. But that was really when this started to take off. And it's really interesting when you look back at the historical record, you see that there was a lot, on the one hand, there was a lot of concern about what people called at that time, I think still today, the digital divide. This idea that there's a lot of concern concerned that with the rise of the internet and the World Wide Web and email, that people were going to be left behind, and that it was going to be another way that men were using these tools more than women, and white people were using these tools more than people of color, and people with money had more access to them than people without money. And there was a lot of concern about that, and I think that still is a legitimate concern and something we talk about today. But at the same time, a lot of those people who were most marginalized recognized the potential in online forms of communication, and progressive social movements of all kinds really were the leaders in taking these tools and figuring out ways to use them for their own ends. So it's interesting, if you're interested in this, you can Google the Wayback Machine, which is that has actually archived a lot of early sites, and I've been doing some really fascinating research where I'm looking at the early feminist presence on the web in the 1990s and seeing the ways that women and trans people, actually, of all kinds, were creating blogs, finding ways to communicate with one another through the web at this really pivotal early moment. And that has been really transformative. It's been democratized. I mean, there's hierarchies on the web like there are anywhere else, but in a way this has really been a key place that's provided a platform for women of color, for working class people to have their voices heard and to put their ideas out there. And also to the point where we are today, where the mainstream media actually has to answer and follow the incredible organizing and communication that's going on online.
When we're not addicted to Twitter for reasons that we won't have to talk about here. Lisa Levenstein, a history professor at UNC Greensboro, is going to stay with us as we continue our conversation about the past, present, and future of the movement for gender equality on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, recording at the Friday Center in Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow. The American feminist movement has been around for more than a century, and the fight for gender equality has gone through many iterations. On today's program, we're looking at where the movement is today, what are the priorities, and who are the people propelling it forward. We're taping a special show in front of a live audience as part of a year-long celebration of the 20th anniversary of the Carolina Women's Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Still with me is Lisa Levenstein, a professor of history at UNC Greensboro, who specializes in the history of women's movements. And joining the conversation now is Naomi Randolph. She is executive director of Women Advance. That's a nonpartisan organization that works to build community around women's issues in North Carolina. Naomi, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here. Naomi, how do you see the feminist movement now? Where are we?
We are in an interesting place, and I think that Lisa's benchmark of 1995, and I thought about myself in 1995 and what I was doing and what I was engaged in, which actually had me kind of say, oh, yeah, that was happening, right? The niches of women organizing with women that they necessarily didn't know before or couldn't get to before. So thank you, Lisa, for amplifying that and bringing that memory back to me. From our viewpoint, the movement is both experiencing a renaissance, and we're also in peril. That interesting dichotomy. So the space in terms in which I believe that we're in a renaissance is that all of these wonderful, dynamic, vibrant voices are coming into the movement with full voice. So people are not creeping in. You know, sometimes when you join something, you kind of sit in the back and take a... No. People are coming in fully amplified and fully clear about what it is that's important to them, what their values are as a part of the movement. So, and they're inserting that, integrating that into the moment, into the work in the moment. So from that space, I think we're in a renaissance. I think that there are lots of beautiful things being birthed in the movement right now. And things that are making people uncomfortable, and things that are making people hopeful, all of that. I also think that we're in peril. And the reason I think that we're in peril is because we have to be collectively a bit more visionary, and I think that we also have to be a bit more strategic. The moment that we have been in over the past 15 years, perhaps, maybe the past 20 years, has us being very reactionary. So we're responding to things consistently. We're responding to things. If we historically, Lisa's our historian on the panel, if we look at movements and their sustainability and their survival, there has to be a space at which you're not responding all the time and you're building. And so as a movement, we have to find a balance of being able to bring in all of these new wonderful voices, to also have a framework to bring them into, and then to have our eye on 2040, 2050. Mm-hmm. What do we want to not have a conversation about in 2050, right?
What do we want to have been solved by?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, your organization builds bridges across different groups in the state, but I was interested in what you said. Collectively, we have to have a sharper vision. As an amateur student of history, one of the things that I find remarkable about the women's movement is that with all of the tensions that it has endured, it has managed to stay together, and there is something about the collective nature of it that has been able to embrace all of the tensions and challenges.
Yeah.
But what do you mean when you talk about a collective vision? Because if I think of vision, mm-hmm. I think of, you know, an individual who sees the shining light on the hill and everybody else follows.
Right.
How do you do that collectively?
So I think it's all of the individuals who see the shiny light, mm-hmm. right? And then everybody moves toward that shining light together. So because there are so many pieces to the women's movement, and it is, I think, one of the most intersectional movements that are in motion in the moment, that means that we have to have the opportunity to be reflective together. I think that's one of the successes of the movement in general, that it has been reflective over the course of time. So, you know, if you think about the 60s and you think about women coming out of the civil rights movement into the women's rights movement, but still maintaining allegiance to the civil rights movement or the workers' rights movements, and then having to have those conversations with women who were not women of color or perhaps women who were not engaged in the civil rights movement, and levels of accountability having to be created. So that nature of being reflective consistently generation after generation is a way in which I think that we are moving toward being visionary. I think that there absolutely have to be more eyeball-to-eyeball conversations with people, that we build vision that way as well. And again, if we're consistently reacting to things all the time, then we can't have the great conversations that we've had as a panel waiting to go on.
Well, what are some of the most successful examples that you've had in coalition building along those lines?
Yeah. So I think the example of reproductive justice and reproductive rights is a great example of coalition building in the women's movement. There is this piece around not having to, there's no dogma around whether you are pro-life or pro-choice, but there is absolutely a value around the ability to have the freedom to choose which you want to be, right? But then there's also a piece about connecting reproductive justice and reproductive rights beyond reproduction. So the ability to choose when I have children, what my family looks like, how long I want to stay in the workforce. So the ability to plan your family, right, is a coalition win, I think, for the movement. The other thing I think that is a win for the movement, Frank, is this deconstruction of normative behavior and false narratives. Without owning any major media outlets, there's Oprah, and then there's everybody else, right? and so, women don't own major media outlets, right. Not really. But to Lisa's point earlier, the online spaces, the ways in which women naturally kind of move toward organizing themselves and work with one another, I think that effort of deconstructing consistently, when and wherever you are, false narratives, and deconstructing normative behavior that is oppressive to women and to people of color very often.
So that's what's happening in the digital space, and mm-hmm. you're saying there's more of that going on, and that's opening our thinking and opening our minds. Lisa, you know, on the topographic space, we've got marches, and I wonder whether you think, and I'm going to ask you about the impact of the Women's March from earlier this year, and whether any of this is adding up to or having an impact. And I know we can't expect it overnight, but do you see an impact from all of this?
Yeah, so I actually had the pleasure of spending this past weekend in New Orleans, Louisiana, with an organization called Sister Song, who is a women of color-led organization that has really pioneered the reproductive justice framework that Naomi was talking about, the idea that if we are going to think about women's autonomy and control over their bodies, we can't just think about abortion rights, but we need to think more holistically about women's bodily autonomy. And so this group, I mean, it's really fascinating. This group did begin in the 1990s, and they were funded by the Ford Foundation, got their start that way. A coalition of Native American women, Latinas, Asian American, and African American women came together. They started out as four groups, four of each group. So 16 groups were at the table. And over the years, this was their 20th anniversary, and they've had several conferences. The first one started with a few hundred people. This one, this past weekend, was 1,000 people in New Orleans in the middle of a threatened hurricane, I might add, and coming together to really meet each other face-to-face and continue to build the movement. And what we see here, we saw at this conference, was both a refining of a vision, a networking time, a time to kind of people replenish themselves. But I think what also is really important about groups like Sister Song and the work that they do is that they have had an impact on the mainstream. So they have changed how Planned Parenthood, for example, speaks about abortion and contraception and women's bodily autonomy. They've changed how organizations like NARAL talk about these things. If you look at the big abortion rights marches in D.C. that have happened over the years, you can see a change in rhetoric from one to the next that is directly correlates to the impact that organizations like Sister Song have had in reshaping how mainstream organizations are thinking about these things. So I do think there's a revisioning and a kind of dreaming and a sense of what do we want that is happening, and that is building and is really, I think, is going to continue to build.
So that's one way to measure impact. But Naomi, let me ask you this question. If we look at the last election and we see that exit polls show 52 or 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump, what do we make of that?
Yeah. So Women Advance is a nonpartisan organization. I want to lead with that. I'm going to lead with that. Thanks, Frank. That's a good question. So I think, you know, I always learn that numbers, you know, tell a story. Hmm. They talk about, in some way, they give us an indication of our values. And so when we look at the fact that 53% of women in the United States of America decided to vote for someone who clearly represented or was engaging in misogynistic behavior, we can factually say that, and decided to look past that, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's something underneath that. And there's a space in which, as we look at the state of North Carolina, rural, urban, suburban, what those numbers indicate in terms of where women were, specifically in this state, right?
And I do think it was 50, and I have to make this distinction. I'm pretty sure it was 53% of white women here.
It was 53% of white women, you're correct.
Not all women.
53% of white women. So there has to be some coalition building and some deeper conversation with women to get a deeper understanding of, so help me understand why you did that, right? Ruby Sales is an activist, an elder in the civil rights movement, and she's written a book called Where Does It Hurt? And so that conversation, where does it hurt, mm-hmm. is a conversation that other white women have to have with white women to get to the deeper space of what's going on here? What's at the root of this? What were their values? What were you afraid of? Mm-hmm. What were you looking forward to? What were you, was it a vote against something versus a vote for something? Because that also exists, right? That paradigm also exists for us collectively. I think that within the women's movement, particularly around the march, right? So we are an advocacy and leadership and a communications organization. And we got lots of information. We were talking about the march and hearing from women about going to the march. And we got lots of feedback from women saying that they didn't feel like the march was something that they could be a part of. That while there were absolutely, and so there were women of color who felt like the march was not a march for them, and then there were women who were a bit more conservative who felt like the march was not a march for them. And so our task is then how do we get all of these pieces of the puzzle of the continuum together in a space to identify where our common good may rest, and how do we consolidate perspectives around that? I think that we have to get, I love Facebook, and I don't tweet, but Facebook, you know, Facebook is a part of our world. I think we have to get from behind our screens and in our cars and be in conversation, intentional conversations with other women, to talk about the world we want to create for our children, the space we want to create for our elder selves. What do those spaces look like, and how do we get there together? And I think that women of color cannot bear the responsibility of engaging that 53% right now, because we're all in a particular kind of space emotionally around that. But I think that there has to be some alliance building and coalition a bit.
Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation now. Saida Estrada is a Latinx services specialist for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Saida, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
You know, the feminist movement has for a long time centered on this idea that the personal is political and that one person's experience has a larger context. And I think your own story can illustrate some of this. Would you tell us a bit of your own story?
So I am a childhood survivor of domestic violence, and that kind of really set me up to be in this movement and to be part of the solution, right? And I say that way because we haven't found the exact solution. And I am going to be referring to the Latino community as Latinx to be inclusive of all gender ideologies and identities. So As a Latinx person, survivor, there are a lot of things within our culture that we are unaware of as children. And I was not aware of the movement or the violence or any of that situation until I was a grown adult. And when I did find out, my world was shifted completely, and I didn't know how to react. My world started spinning. Like, I've been in a family violence for such a long time that, and I didn't even recognize it because of the culture that I was living in. And my personal culture, I cannot speak on everybody else's family culture. And so with that being said, I think it's important for us to take that, me personally, to take that and label it and build these gaps and go in and see where the gap was as a child and try to bridge that.
How much of this, I mean, what was it that brought you to that different awareness and put your experience, your personal experience, in the larger context?
Education, right? And a lot of emphasis on education. And so if it wasn't for that education, I don't know that I would have come to that realization of the amount of violence that I was living in. And so what scared me, I think, as a young adult was not being able to identify this and what happens to those children or those adults that never had the opportunity to be educated or to engage in opening of their mind in such a way, and why does the cycle not end? And so that's what scared me, and that's what propelled me, and that's what engaged me into the movement and to be able to speak on that.
And until you started your position as a Latinx services specialist, there was no one in the North Carolina Coalition for Domestic Violence that specifically focused on Latinx.
Right.
Violence.
So our program is a fairly new program. I've been in this position for nearly a year. And so to be able to take that program and grow it and shape it in a way that has the most impact and best practices for the Latinx community has really been very rewarding.
How do you navigate the the personal story that you have to live with this other now, it's a job. We talked about this being a profession. Right. How does that work for you?
So the job never ends, right? Mm. it's an ongoing job. And it doesn't matter if you're, like Lisa said, if you're paid or not. Like, it's so intertwined for me as a survivor and for a lot of people in the movement, it becomes your life and it becomes this part of the movement. So to me, it's not a movement, it's life, yeah. Right? It becomes life.
And the cultural distinction here is important. This is something that you felt was a distinction that needed to be made because there were specific ways of approaching the problem in Latinx communities and also in rural communities. Things are different than an urban environment, you've discovered.
Right. So coming from a very rural community, and as many of us know, the lack of resources that are even available there, whether or not you have an education or not, doesn't really... It plays a small part of it, but the lack of resources in these rural communities make it that much harder to break the cycle and to propel the movement in those areas. And what you really get is you get the same activists doing all of the work, and it becomes important to this one group and everybody else ignores it. And I think that's the struggle that rural communities face and the struggle that we're seeing throughout North Carolina.
Well, this gets to what Naomi was talking about, too, and Lisa, to a certain extent, that broadening the coalition and seeing a common values and common right. goals in areas that might not have been apparent before would also broaden the workforce, it would seem to me.
Right, and like Naomi said, that collective vision, right, bringing these people from the rural communities into a bigger space where they can expand and join into the vision so that they don't feel as isolated in their own rural communities and bringing them in and showing how to engage in these rural communities and do the work.
Well, I'd like to thank my guests in this segment, Lisa Levenstein, a professor of history at UNC Greensboro. Naomi Randolph is the executive director of the nonprofit Women Advance. And Saida Estrada is the Latinx services specialist for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Thank you for being here. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and on today's show, we're talking about the feminist movement for a special program in celebration of the 20th anniversary of the Carolina Women's Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Now, we've talked about what this movement means for folks today and how it has developed over the years. Now, we want to take a look at where we're heading. We're going to look now to college campuses and younger people who are working in this movement for gender equality. I want to introduce Deatra Jackson, who is the co-director of the nonprofit Ignite NC and the co-chair of the Black Youth Project 100 Durham chapter. Welcome to you, Deatra. Also with us, Paige Meltzer, who is the director of the Women's Center at Wake Forest University. Hello, Paige. And Kennedy Bridges is a junior at UNC Chapel Hill studying psychology and public health, also a former intern with the Carolina Women's Center. Welcome to you, Kennedy. Deatra, let me start with you and ask you how the feminist movement plays into your work as an organizer. You're working with younger people. Maybe you can describe your organization, who you work with, and how you see and frame feminism for the people you work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. So I work with Ignite NC. We're a leadership development fellowship program, and we hire young people, mostly college students, across the state of North Carolina to do the organizing that makes the most sense for them to be doing. At this point, we do a lot of work around gender justice, especially with the launch of HB2 down in North Carolina, and also do a lot of work around sanctuary, again, with the launch of the administration that we have now. Our fellowship program is about 90% black folks and about 70% queer and trans young people from across the state. And we've been around since 2013. And at this point, we have launched over 200 young people as a starting ground of learning political education, political alignment, how to build coalitions, how to organize on their campus, how to start a campus organization that's rooted in a politic that is radical and also that speaks to the Black, queer, trans experience.
How does that frame your work? What does that mean for your work? And where does it fit in the longer, or does it need to fit in sort of the longer view of feminism?
Absolutely. I think that there's multiple ways of being a part of the movement, and one of the ways that we see it is through direct action, through organizing, through base building, through helping people that want to run for office, and supporting, being a support structure for that, for those folks, and building connections and coalitions with other organizations that are doing work across the state. The politic that I work from is from a Black queer feminist lens, and I take that from Black Youth Project 100, where we talk a lot around centering the most marginalized and the most directly impacted by the issues that happen in our society every day. And so continuing the legacy of Black women, specifically from Combahee River Collective and Ella Baker and Marsha P. Johnson, Fannie Lou Hamer, et cetera, wanting to use that as a framework of how we build real power in the state.
Paige Meltzer, let me ask you what it means to, as the director of the Women's Center at Wake Forest University, the role of women's centers. You heard Lisa Levenstein talk about the institutionalization, perhaps going back to the 90s, of the women's movement. What does that mean, and what does it mean to have women's centers? What does that mean for the movement?
Women's centers are spaces to support women and promote gender equity on college campuses, really developing feminist knowledge, attitudes, and skills, building the bridge between the theoretical framework that students are learning in classroom and then their application on the college campuses more broadly, so they're prepared to be feminist change agents in the community at large.
What are the issues that you're seeing now on campus?
Students have been really engaged around DACA. They were really engaged around the travel ban, really thinking again through this intersectional lens that feminist issues are showing up in all areas of our political life.
Well, let me ask you, Kennedy Bridges is a junior at UNC Chapel Hill and a former intern here at the Carolina Women's Center. What do you see as the issues that are facing students these days and that are important to you?
Exactly what you said. A lot of those things, as well as on our campus, there's obviously lots of conversation about sexual violence and how our the administration is supporting or not supporting the survivors in that way. We do our best to engage with the community in Chapel Hill. So my experience with that has been really incredible. So through the MOXIE program, that program is a summer internship, but there's a class in the spring. So through that class, we are given an opportunity to go out into the community, and I was able to work with the Jackson Center to work with the Black residents of Chapel Hill. And so feminism isn't just a women's issue. It also springboards into pretty much every sector of social justice, and so that it's everything. It's everywhere.
Deatra, we saw that there had been certainly fractures and divisions within the women's movement, particularly early on, and tensions over race in the early part of the movement. Some of those have been negotiated, but then we saw in the civil rights movement, too, questions about, and Moral Monday was an example of a rights movement that had to negotiate questions of gender and of gay rights, gender rights, transgender rights, something that was not easy to come by. How do you think the relationship now is in terms of these two kinds of these issues, issues facing African Americans and those facing, you know, gender minorities?
Yeah, my analysis of the movement now, as it looks, can be a little one-sided. As I'm an organizer, I work with a lot of the folks that are engaged all the time in the movement and are in constant analysis. One thing that I do do see specifically at some of the HBCU students and at the school level, North Carolina has more HBCUs than any other state in the country. And we see the divides just at the HBCUs of how difficult it is to have a women and gender studies major at the schools. Right now, there is 2 HBCUs in the entire country that have a women and gender studies major. And those are like really recent, like the past 2-3 years. And so we see that there's a continuous fight just within a very small sector at the university level just to have a women and gender studies
Can I ask
major.
You, and forgive me for interrupting, but can you tell me why that might be true?
Anybody? Next question.
All right. Well, you can continue, but that does make it more difficult to organize then on those
extremely,
campuses.
Extremely.
Yeah. Well, Paige, let's talk about what's happening today in terms of the polarization that we're seeing in politics in general, certainly over these kinds of cultural issues. What's been the impact?
I mean, students are going to find their way to women's centers as long as we operate in the current existing, sort of our larger political structure, and I don't mean that specifically about this administration, I mean more broadly, right? And so as we see the larger political divide, that may make for some more difficult conversations across party lines, but I think that the really important thing is that we continue to come back to the idea that Naomi was talking about earlier around connecting with people and their individual stories and being able to build empathy with people who are experiencing similar kinds of issues, perhaps differently than we are, right? So it may not be the exact same point where we're approaching a particular issue, but we can have a shared discussion about how it's impacting our lives.
Well, Lisa Levenstein was talking about changing the narrative and changing the rhetoric around some of these issues that becomes a way for more people to see themselves as see these issues as important to them. Is that something that's happening at women's centers? Are you taking a look at sort of how the issue is being framed in ways that might include more people?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that women's centers do well is to get people to think critically about the water that we swim in, right? Part of it is that we're just swimming in a lot of accepted notions around gender, race, class, sexual orientation, all the different kinds of identities. And so women's centers raise those kinds of discussions and make that more accessible to a broader campus community. And so the more that women's centers get to do that, the more we get to do that kind of education on our campuses and empower our students to be able to ask those questions and carry that work forward.
Deidre, it always seems that this is a fine balance that in any kind of studies program and any kind of organizing around identity that you have to strike, a balance that you have to strike. On the one hand, to empower people, to allow them to speak with their own voice in their own identity is a powerful thing. On the other hand, it also reinforces the difference, which is the thing that creates the polarization. How do you navigate that challenge?
Yeah, I think... like you said, on the one hand, there's this space of wanting people to feel in their most free selves, and then there's also this navigation that we have to have around what what makes the most sense and what's the most strategic.
Kennedy, I know you talked about sexual violence being something sort of top of mind on the campus these days. And you have been active in educating students around Title IX and its relationship to all this. Tell us more about your work.
So that comes through my work with One Act. So One Act is a program through the student wellness that helps to teach other that gets students to teach other students about how to be a bystander and how to give other students resources and the power to access those resources. So Title IX is obviously a big part of that. So learning the policy around sexual violence and how state organizations like UNC are supposed to deal with those things. And knowing your rights is a very important part of that power. So,
Paige, how would you say the role of women's studies centers has changed over time, and how do you see things going forward?
Well, I love to see be here on a 20th anniversary year of the Carolina Women's Center, and you get to see, again, that institutionalization that Lisa spoke about earlier. My center at Wake Forest University is only 5 years old, right? And so we see that we continue to be in moments that institutions need women's centers to do that work and are continuing to bring them onto college campuses and making that an important offering and part of the student experience.
And what about taking that experience off campus? Is it meant for this kind of academic environment? And then how is it taken to the streets?
Women's centers help create avenues for students to engage in community activism. Part of that, though, I want to also just come back to this idea about where is your voice and what are the spaces that are meaningful to you so that you can fully be yourself. And students identifying for themselves what are the issues that are the most important for them to be working on and how to be engaged in communities with communities and not just sort of going into a community, right? And that's part of the work that we on colleges' campuses have to do as well so that students are working in partnership with and recognizing the assets in the communities that they're also seeking to be part of and serve.
Deidre, you were talking about HBCUs, the small number of women's centers. Do you see things changing, or what approach do you take to try to institute those centers where there seem to be very few?
Yeah, it's very complicated, just like everything else. There are organizations that are working specifically around building LGBTQ centers and women and gender studies programs at HBCUs. The National Black Justice Coalition is one of those organizations. And also, I think that there is a organizing strategy that people have been doing for a very long time, but that folks in the movement are continuing to work around, which is building alternatives. And so folks... students and young people have been working really hard to create things such as safe spaces, safe zones, things like that on their campus because they don't have the Women and Gender Studies program that can be a place of political education and alignment.
Kennedy, I wonder what the impact of the Women's Studies, Women's Center here at UNC has been for you. Did you come to campus knowing that this was the kind of work you wanted to do, or what role did the center play in shaping your ideas around this?
Wow, a huge impact. The Women's and Gender Studies Department, in partnership with the Women's Center, has changed what I understood feminism to be and my place in that. So largely through the Moxie program was a huge part of that. So it allowed me to completely changed what I thought my skill set was. It completely changed what I thought my life in this movement was going to be. And so I was able to open up myself to politics, to really getting in that space. So I thought I was just going to do kind of the social part of that, not the political part. I thought that was a possibility. No. So this summer I was able to work with the ERA and NC Alliance. Through that program, I got to be in the legislature. I got to talk to and tell people about why the Equal Rights Amendment needed to happen 100 years ago and why it still needs to happen now. I got to learn what community activism really is about, learn what the grassroots movements were really about. I got to learn how the history of the women's movement still impacts what it looks like today. So I guess that answered your question.
I want to thank all of my guests. That's the good answer. That's a good answer. Kennedy Bridges, Paige Meltzer, and Deidre Jackson. Paige is the director of the Women's Center at Wake Forest University. Kennedy is a junior at UNC Chapel Hill and a former intern at the Carolina Women's Center. Deidre is co-director of the nonprofit Ignite NC and co-chair of the Black Youth Project 100 Durham chapter. I want to thank all of you for being with us on our program today. I want to thank you and congratulate you at the Carolina Women's Center, UNC Chapel Hill, for their help with this program and their 20th anniversary, UNC Women's Center. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director, and a big thanks to the rest of our tech crew and engineering support team, Al Wadarski, John Hardy, Graham Youngblood, all helped to make this recording possible. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.